This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. How's your identity capital doing? Been making the most of the weak ties in your world? Ever tried shopping for jam when facing a tough decision? Actually, the new book that's our focus this hour is full of unique techniques for decision-making in work, love, family, relationships. In just the few weeks since publication, this new volume's been winning praise from all quarters. Maybe that's because, even though the book is aimed at people in their 20s, the psychologist who wrote it seemed determined to speak to all of us about how the choices we make end up structuring our lives. So whether you're in your 20s yourself, know someone who is, or would just like to understand a bit more about how your life has become what it has, please stay tuned as we ask Dr. Meg Jay to explain the findings in her new book, The Defining Decade, right after the news. I'm Tom Graham, and this is Virginia Insight. Are you now, or have you ever been, between the ages of 20 and 29? If you've already made it through that age group, do you feel yourself to be older and wiser? We're hoping you can help us with this question. Say you could go back in time and visit yourself in your 20s. What one piece of advice would you most like to give yourself? Anything at all come to mind? Well, then, please tell us about it. 888-WMRA-TALK. Now, if you are currently in your 20s, what type of advice do you think you could most use? We'd love to hear from you, too, at 888-967-2825. The book is titled The Defining Decade, Why Your 20s Matter and How to Make the Most of Them Now. Its author, psychologist Meg Jay, is our guest. Dr. Jay, thanks so much for making time for us.
Great to be here, Tom.
Well, what will somebody get from reading this book?
Well, they'll hopefully get the subtitle. The subtitle is Why Your 20s Matter and How to Make the Most of Them Now. So the book is really about the developmental importance, the personal importance of those years, and how to feel that you've gotten all you could get out of that developmental sweet spot.
Why is it a developmental sweet spot?
Because a lot is happening that's never quite happened before in this way, then it'll never quite happen again in this way. So I'm going to rattle off some numbers. So we know that 80% of life's most defining moments happen by the age of 35. Two-thirds of lifetime wage growth happens in the first 10 years of a career. More than half of Americans are married or are living with or dating their future partner by 30. Most people don't know this, but personality changes more in our 20s than any time before or after. Female fertility peaks at 28, and our brain caps off its last growth spurt. So these are years when the things that we do and the things we don't do are going to have an inordinate impact on the years to come.
80% of life's most defining moments happen by the age 35?
35.
What? Tell me more about what. What does that mean?
What does that mean? This actually comes
from... My life is over at this
point. You and I are mostly defined. Let's put it that way. It comes out of great research out of University of Michigan and Boston University, and they looked at autobiographical stories written by successful people toward the end of their lives, and they traced back the starting point for the moments, the jobs, the relationships that made the biggest difference on the years to follow. 80% of those defining moments, of those autobiographically consequential events, took place by the age of 35. But the really important, interesting finding there was that the individuals did not recognize how consequential these events were at the time. So the take-home of that is that your 20s really matter, and it may not feel like it. And I think that's where the book has really inspired people and educated people in ways where they can look at their 20s and see, oh, I am making decisions that are going to impact my life, even though it may not be clear to me.
You give so many wonderful examples in this book, The Defining Decade, Meg Jay. I hope we'll have a chance to get to several of them. But I'm wondering if you can give some specifics about what you're talking about right now. Can you think of an example of something somebody did in their 20s that ended up really making a difference in terms of where life was for them in their 40s or 50s?
Absolutely. I start the defining decade right after the introduction. We start with work, and that's because most 20-somethings That's their first challenge. They know they need to make a living. They need to make it happen. And they go out there and they try to figure out what to do with work. And 20-something jobs may not feel very consequential. They're usually not very glamorous. But they can earn 20-somethings what's called identity capital. That's the first chapter of the book, is how important it is to get some identity capital in your 20s.
So you're going to have to define that.
I will. It is the things that we do related to work or pursuits that really craft and distinguish and empower our identities so that we mean something to other people. So I'll give you an example of my identity capital. I graduated from UVA 20 years ago, and the first thing I did right after was I went to work for Outward Bound, which was, you know, not a particularly ambitious job necessarily in terms of career, but it had a lot of identity capital. People knew roughly what that was, that felt like it was an experience that had value and set me apart from other people, so that when I went to go to graduate school, I waltzed right in largely because of that identity capital.
So there may be a few people who are not really sure
what
Outward Bound is. So explain a little bit about what that experience was for you,
right,
if you could.
It's an outdoor education organization. It's all over the world, and it works especially with special populations. So I tromped around in the woods.
And special populations often being young people, I don't know, anywhere from the age of, 12 to 16 or 17?
No. I mean, that's one of the groups. But I worked especially with special populations ranging from Vietnam vets, Wall Street CEOs, adjudicated youth, survivors of violence. And
the adjudicated youth is one of the ones that you go into in detail in your
yes.
book. Explain the term adjudicated youth.
Adjudicated youth, those are teens who have been busted for crimes, and they were basically serving their sentence with me by canoeing down the Suwannee River, all 350 miles from the Okefenokee Swamp to the Gulf of Mexico.
So you were in all kinds of challenging circumstances out in the wilderness with groups of people everywhere from high-flying CEOs to youngsters who'd gotten in trouble with the law.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result of, you did this for about 4 years.
Yeah, I did.
Between your undergraduate
mm-hmm.
degree and when you went to graduate school. And then when you started applying to graduate schools,
this
everybody wanted to ask you.
Everybody
about
was interested. This helped me stand out. And I went to graduate school in clinical psych. It's a very, very competitive field. And when I went to interviews, I was ready to talk about studies and data and what I might do for my dissertation. All anyone wanted to talk about was Outward Bound.
As soon as they saw that on your resume.
Yes. And here we are talking about it 20 years later, that it was a piece of capital that has served me again and again. And so I work all the time with 20-somethings about when they're trying to choose between one job and another. The question I almost always pose to them is, what is going to get you the most identity capital? Because that's going to help you get the next job and the next job and the next job.
So,
and that's how you build a career.
Identity capital is something, for one thing, it's going to look good on a resume. For another, it's going to help you understand the world around you, maybe in a different way. It's going to give you connections with important stuff in your world that's going to have an influence on your future?
Absolutely. I mean, you can think of it broadly as an investment you make in yourself. And so I think too often college graduates feel like, I got to get out there and pay my dues. It's not quite that. It's investing in yourself, doing something that's going to allow you to go out there and purchase metaphorically the next thing that you want. It's going to help you get that next job or that next informational interview or coffee date or whatever it is. And so 20-somethings, one of the pivotal things they can do in their 20s is go out and earn one or two pieces of good capital that can trump 4 years of a GPA or 4 years of a poor GPA can be trumped with one good piece of capital.
And the sense I got from reading this book, The Defining Decade, Why Your 20s Matter and How to Make the Most of Them Now, is that you've had a lot of experience, Dr. J, with young people who feel like their 20s, at least after they finish their undergraduate degree, should be a time of expanded freedom and joy and party and not worrying about their future. And you're nodding your head. And I also get the sense, Meg, that you think that this is a fairly new phenomenon, that maybe 20 or 30 years ago you wouldn't have found these attitudes among most 20-somethings?
I think 20 years ago you would have, because 20 years ago I was a 20-something, and I have to confess that that was part of our culture as Gen Xers. I mean, we were postponing also. I don't know that 20... I think that the myth is that 20-somethings think, and that 20-something, the years are for partying and freedom and exploration. I think that's a bit of a misunderstanding, because at the end of the day, it's not that fun being a 20-something. And I think a lot of 20-somethings feel saddled with this idea of, these are supposed to be the best years of my life. Everyone says so, and they're kind of awful. And so part of the work I do with people is to help them see the 20-something years for what they really are. You know, probably not the best years of your life, in a lot of ways not the freest years of your life, because you may not have the ability to do all those things you hear you're supposed to be out there doing. But I do think there's a cultural message that everyone's doing things later now. And so many 20-somethings feel like they don't really know how to get going or why they should get going. I had one sent me a tweet about something basically saying, you know, the 20s are for killing time. And I think a lot of people feel like, I'm just killing time until life comes together, which I hear is at about 30.
Is it true then that part of the reason you wanted to write this book is that you wanted to respond to that idea?
Absolutely.
And to convince people that that's not a correct idea?
Well, it can be a harmful idea, because I have a lot of 20-somethings in my office who feel like, I don't know whether I should get going or how to get going. And that's anemia. That's not a great way to feel. And even worse, I have 30-somethings and 40-somethings in my office who say, what was I thinking? What was I doing? I'm in my 30s and I've missed my best chance to start my career or find meaningful relationships.
Dr. Meg Jay, author of the new book, The Defining Decade, is our guest. Somewhere in our audience right now is a parent who has one or more children in or near their 30s. If you are that parent, do you have concerns about the kinds of decisions your kids are or are not making about their future? We've got a phone line open for you at 888-WMRA-TALK. You can also post to us on any topic related to what you're hearing here on the air on our Facebook page, where we're listed as Virginia Insight. And Carolyn has done that, I think, responding to her question about, if you could go back and talk to yourself in your 20s, what advice would you give yourself? And she says, I can think of a number of pieces of advice I'd give my 20-year-old self, but none I feel comfortable sharing with the world. Is that a common phenomenon? I mean, in your therapy work as a psychologist, Dr. J, you don't only have clients who are in their 20s. You've got people in their 30s and 40s and older. Do people have a sense of shame about the decisions that they made in their 20s very frequently?
Sometimes. But what I find interesting about the person who posted on Facebook, you said Carolyn, is that her name? That she has advice she would like to give, but won't. And I think that happens a lot for 20-somethings. They're hungry for advice. They're hungry for information. And I give it to them, whether it's in session or in the book. I don't hold back on what I have learned, specializing in adult development and young adult development. They actually want to hear it. And I think that is refreshing and different, and that's what people said they've appreciated about the defining decade, is I'm not just a therapist nodding and letting people walk backwards into a life they don't want. I say, hey, wait a minute, let's talk about what we really know about the 20s and how you can use them.
Is that just because you're a therapist, or could anybody in their 40s or 50s or older have a conversation with somebody in their 20s that they're concerned about and look for an opportunity to give advice?
Of course they should. They can and they should.
I see. Maybe we confuse early 20s with teen years, but I would imagine many older people think, well, they really don't want advice from me.
They don't want to hear it. It's not true. It's not true, because I'm getting emails from them about the book, and that's not what my clients say. They're hungry for information. They may not act like they're listening, but they are.
When we get back, I want to ask you about Benjamin Franklin, Eric Erickson, and weak links, all things contained in your book. Dr. Meg Jay, who has been a psychologist in private practice in the Bay Area of California and in the Charlottesville region of Virginia, as well as taught psychology at Berkeley and at UVA, is our guest. Her new book is titled The Defining Decade, Why Your 20s Matter and How to Make the Most of Them. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. Call-in phone number, 888-WMRA-TALK. You got this wonderful story early in your book about Ben Franklin.
Mm-hmm. It is a wonderful story. It's about what's called the Ben Franklin effect, which I learned about that through teaching social psychology. A lot of what's in The Defining Decade is really what I learned about young adulthood and about adult development in general from teaching for many years different disciplines or different areas within psychology. But the Ben Franklin effect is about the phenomenon that when people do favors for us, they start to like us more.
So take us through the example you give in your book of what Ben Franklin actually did early in his political career.
He was a state legislator in Pennsylvania, of course, and he wanted to make a connection with another legislator who didn't seem that interested in him.
Who was very senior and quite powerful.
Yes. And so he asked, he did a little bit of research on this man and found out he had a special interest in a particular area. And Ben Franklin asked to borrow a book that he
sent him a note.
Sent him a note, I believe, that said, you know, may I borrow this book? I understand you have it in your library. Would you mind doing me that favor? So the man agreed and he lent him the book. And that, as subsequent studies in social psychology down the line have shown, that when people do one favor for us, they're more likely to do another and another and another, and that doing a favor for someone really gets them on your side because it gives them a chance to feel altruistic and that it's good to be good. And so this person did a favor for Ben Franklin, and they forged a relationship, and he did another and another, and they were close friends until the day that he died. And so what I do a lot with clients of all ages, but especially young clients who are extremely hesitant to do this, is I tell them to ask people for favors, to ask senior people for favors, whether that's an informational interview or a letter of recommendation or a suggestion for a book to read, that if you know what someone has expertise in and you ask them to help you, you'll be surprised that people are more willing to help than you might imagine. And then once they help you, they're more likely to help again and again. They become on the hook for future favors.
Is part of the Ben Franklin story and the Ben Franklin effect that it was something fairly small and an easy favor to give on the part of the person he was asking it, and it was very specific,
yes,
and it was in that person's area of expertise or interest?
Yes, definitely. And I talk about that in the chapter, helping 20-somethings figure out what kind of favor to ask for when they maybe go to someone in the field they're interested in working in, to ask for something specific, something small that the person can easily do, whether for some people that is an informational interview, half an hour of their time is no big deal. For other people, that is a big deal, and maybe they're more likely to give you a quick email recommendation. Those are the kinds of things to ask for that it's easy for someone to do, so why not do it? Where 20-somethings get into trouble is when they ask for broad, non-specific, can you figure out the answers to my life favors? And that really requires the helper to do all the thinking for the person. Those aren't the kind of favors. So people will sometimes email me and say, you know, should I be a folk singer or a social worker? This is not something that I can unpack in an email. That's going to take too much of my time, not to mention I can't really answer that question.
Tell us more about the phenomenon you mentioned a moment ago, Dr. J, about it's good to be good.
Mm-hmm. It's good to be good. Altruism, we know altruism is associated with practically every positive health and personal outcome you can think of, unless the help is overwhelming. So for helpers out there who are overextending themselves, altruism backfires. That's why if you ask people for favors that aren't overwhelming, they're happy to do them. It makes them feel good about themselves, and it makes them feel good in relation to you because they know they've helped you and you give them that opportunity and you become a good figure in that person's life.
And so I would think that this might be something that applies not just to anybody in their 20s,
yes,
but the whole idea of realizing that somebody who has some expertise often feels good if they are asked in a way that's easy for them to respond, to share some of that, to do a favor,
yes,
that then the person you're asking the favor of, you're actually giving them an opportunity to feel good about themselves.
Yes, and that's why the Ben Franklin effect works. I mean, that's why it is what it is. You're doing a favor to somebody by letting them do a favor for you. And it's sort of, we talked about identity capital. You just need one or two good pieces to get a career going. You just need one or two people to do a favor for you, whether that's call someone up about a job opening or send an email on your behalf, and that can be transformative for a young person's career. One person picking up the phone one time, and then you've got your first piece of identity capital, and things build from there.
How is Facebook changing young people's view of themselves?
Well, it had, like everything, it has upsides and downsides. The upsides are, going back to the Ben Franklin effect, it's easier than ever to connect with people and reach out and ask for favors or to stay present in people's minds because you're on their Facebook list of friends or you're on their Twitter follow or you're on their GChat. Facebook specifically is challenging for 20-somethings. A lot of them sit in my office and feel pretty bad about their lives because they look at Facebook and everyone else's lives seem to be going so well. That one of my clients calls his Facebook page his self-advertisement, that he knows that he only posts the pictures where he looks the best and he's standing around with the coolest people or the best-looking people, and that's what he puts up about himself. That's what most of us put up on Facebook, only the good stuff. And so when you're sitting on the couch in your sweatpants and eating a lean cuisine and you're surfing Facebook and you look around, everybody else's lives seem to be going so well, yours not so much. That's what we call an upward social comparison because everybody looks high, we feel low, and that makes us feel bad about ourselves.
And people in their 20s are probably paying attention to Facebook more than any other age group, or certainly more than anybody older than
yes.
20s. And this sense of other people are succeeding much more with their lives than I am
yes.
can become oppressive.
Very oppressive. You would be stunned by the number of hours a week I spend talking people down from Facebook, that they feel like everyone's getting promoted, everyone's getting married, everyone's having babies, when statistically this cannot be possible. And when I talk to them about the realities of it, of, well, what friends have you ever mentioned in session are actually getting married right now or actually feel that they've arrived in their career, then they can't really come up with anybody. But in terms of Facebook, you're exposed to so many people in almost a composite sense. One of my clients said it so well. I wish I could remember exactly what she said, but maybe no one person has it all, but collectively out there on Facebook, you know, they do have it all. And it's sort of that one person against their 300 friends.
Clinical psychologist Meg Jay is our guest. Dr. Jay's new book is titled The Defining Decade, Why Your 20s Matter, and How to Make the Most of Them. So to you who are listening, I'm curious, have you noticed anything different about the lifestyles and or decision-making abilities of people in their 20s today compared to 10, 20, 30 years ago? We're looking for your perspective at 888-WMRA-TALK. That's 888-967-2825. And on Facebook, we are listed as Virginia Insight if you'd prefer to type instead of talk and post a question or comment on our Facebook page. We've talked a lot about what you devote a lot of time and effort to in the first section of your book, but you also talk about things completely different than work later on in the book.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that may surprise people is the degree to which 20-somethings are worried about relationships, or once they get out of their 20s, worried that they've made some big mistakes in terms of planning for their future when
yes.
it comes to relationships.
Yes,
tell
absolutely.
Us about that.
You know, I'd say 20-somethings are probably more worried about their relationships than they are about work. They'd rather spend more time talking about that and probably reading about that. I started with work because logistically you really have to, but a book about how to get going in your 20s would not be complete without a full section on love and a section of looking forward toward family planning. And do you want a family? A Pew Center study showed that the majority of 20-somethings, they say their top priority is to be a good parent. That's their top priority in life. And so we have to work backwards from that, do some reverse engineering to how do I date the right people? How do I get myself into a good relationship? How do I build a good committed partnership or marriage? How many kids do I think I might want? And what do I need to do before that? Because you can't do it all at 35.
There's this old therapist trick I understand that if I keep quiet, you might tell me more about it.
But if we both do it, no one will say anything. So I'll talk. So, you know, let's talk about that, about family. People were surprised. I have a chapter. It's at the end of the defining decade. It's probably next to last chapter about fertility. And some people's reaction was, why would you put a chapter about fertility in a 20-something book? That's a 30-something issue. That's when things start going wrong. That's when we have the conversation. And, well, I disagree with that. Not enough people know that female fertility peaks at 28, so it is actually quite relevant to the 20-something years. But I don't think it's fair to educate people about the statistics of fertility and infertility once they are a statistic. A lot of 30-somethings resent not knowing that they needed to think a little bit more about timing, about maybe getting serious sooner about who they were dating, thinking more about when they might not like to have not just that first child. Can I pull off my first child at 37? But how many kids do I want to have? And how old am I going to be when I have that last child? And will I have all the kids that I want? There's a lot of disappointment out there now, people feeling like I didn't have all the kids I wanted to have. Or I had to have them in a way that was very compressed and stressful. And I didn't know I was choosing that, but when I was making my 20-something choices. And we actually are. That the 20-something choices we're making has a domino effect in terms of the families we are and aren't having in our 30s. And it's perfectly fine to have your kids in your 30s. I did. But there are things you have to do before that, such as maybe get going on your career, maybe start looking for someone to settle down with.
Obviously, I'm not female, but in reading your book, The Defining Decade, I was startled at the statistics you were talking about, it, about the degree and the percentage of women who actually have trouble with fertility as of about the age of 35.
Right. That it drops, fertility drops quite rapidly from 28 to 35, and then really rapidly at 35, and then plummets at 40. And Hollywood gives us the impression that you can have your kids at 40. People are doing it all the time, but it's not as simple as they make it out to be. I had a client that I discuss in the book where she said, you know, I don't even want to think about who I'm dating, because I was challenging her to take her dating life a little more seriously in her 20s. She said, I don't even want to think about who I'm dating. My plan, I'm going to get married at 40 and have kids at 45. And, you know, I push back on that of, really? Is that really your plan? Because if it is, we need to talk about that. I don't think that's a plan that's going to work. And when I started to have that conversation with her, she felt hesitant and said, well, okay, no, I guess it's not really my plan to get married at 40 and have kids at 45. But we got out a pen and paper and said, what is the timeline and how is this all going to add up? And the way she had it.
And tell us more about timeline. This is a critical thing you use.
Yeah, we made a timeline because she said, you know, I might go to law school and I'm about 30. You know, 30 is the new 20. I'll go to law school at 30. Then maybe, you know, maybe.
And you take issue with the whole idea that 30 is the new 20.
It is. I do take issue with it for the reasons, you know, we talked about. 20s are a developmental sweet spot. You can't jam into your 30s all those opportunities and all those pivotal moments that they.
So if you actually begin to put down on paper on this timeline of when you're going to do what, and you're talking, how old was this client?
She was maybe 26 or 27 and kind of thought, she was very hesitant to make a commitment. In her case, it was to law school, although it was clear that was the next step that she had thought the most about or that made the most sense.
And but, since she'd been out of school for a few years, there were some steps that were going to be time consuming before
sure.
she could even get into law school.
Sure. She had to do the application. She had to take the LSAT. She had to get references. This was going to be a good year plus of work. So I did a timeline with her. We said, okay, you start the process up at 30. You do that preschool work. You do your 3 years of school. You do the bar. You'd start your career at 35. How does that sound to you? And she said, well, that could be okay. So I said, okay. So, and then what did you say? Marriage at 40, kids at 45. Should I write that in here? And when I did that, she started to get hesitant. Marriage at 40 and kids at 45 didn't start, really didn't sound realistic to her. And she knew that, but she'd just been sort of tossing it into the distance. And she said, well, no, I'd like to get married sooner, and I'd probably like to have my first child by 35. So I said, okay, so let's look at our timeline. We've got you going to law school, getting married, and having a baby in the same 5 year span.
Yeah.
Is that going to work for you? And she said, well, no, I don't want to have a baby in law school. And I said, well, then I think you better go to law school now. That get going on school, that was something she knew she wanted to do, but was sort of pushing it to the future because it sounded like a commitment, and that was worrisome to her. And then bring family a little closer in because it's something she wanted, and tossing it into the future was not necessarily going to work out for her.
In your book, Dr. Meg Jay, The Defining Decade, it's a very conversational style. You assign names while protecting identities, pseudonyms, I guess you would call them, to different clients and tell their stories. But if anybody looks at the back of the book, they'll see that pretty much everything that you're talking about is based on a lot of scientific research that's been going on over the past few years. One of the things that you cite is the degree to which people living together is actually not good for a successful marriage. And that's probably going to surprise people. It seems counterintuitive. Tell us about that.
Yes. It's not necessarily good for marriage. Let's put it that way. I think, like most things, it has upsides and it has downsides. We hear about the upsides of it's we hear that it's low risk, it's easy to get in, it's easy to get out, I can test my relationship before I marry the person. But what we don't hear are the downsides, and that is that it's harder to get out of a cohabiting relationship than people anticipate. So what I routinely see in my office are clients who say, we're 20-somethings, we're having sex, we spend most of our time together, it's cheaper, it's easier, it's more fun to live together, we're going to do that. What's the harm? If it doesn't work out, we'll move out. We'll just move on. And sure, that can happen. But what I hear about a lot are clients who say, I stayed with someone 3, 4, 5 years that I shouldn't have been with more than a year because we were living together and it was just too hard to get out. So I think people need to be aware of what's called lock-in. And that's that phenomena when you make an investment in something, you combine assets and resources. It's harder to get out from that than people think. One of my clients said she thought of living together as a quick exit, that if it didn't work out, it was a quick exit. And she very aptly said it felt more like quicksand. So I'm not against living together, but I'm for people being aware of that so they can do a gut check on, am I still with this person because they're a real potential partner for me?
Or one of the other things that you say in your book is that people making a decision to live together, that their standards are much less rigorous than
absolutely.
If they were talking about getting married.
Of course.
So that you may decide to cohabitate with somebody who you wouldn't think about marrying at that point
absolutely.
In time. And then you
that's
find
generally
that you're
the case.
Stuck with somebody that you don't want to be stuck with.
Exactly. That's often what happens.
We have Robert here with a comment on Facebook. We'll get to that, Robert, when we get back in just about 1 minute. When Meg Jay finished her undergraduate degree at the University of Virginia, she went to work the very next day at something that would be a topic of a conversation with most every new person she encountered for years to come. Meg went to work at the base camp of the Blue Ridge Mountains of Outward Bound. As she highlights in her new book, that experience there had many benefits, not the least of which helping her get into her first choice for graduate school. You're welcome to ask her more about that if you'd like, or any other questions about the challenges of decision-making, whether you are in your 20s yourself or any other age. Her new book is titled The Defining Decade, Why Your 20s Matter and How to Make the Most of Them. So here on Facebook, we have this post from Robert who says, I've passed my 20s. I'm in my 50s now, But if I knew then what I know now, I would not have done a lot of the cool things I did. Thoughts?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a lot of thoughts. This is something you hear a lot, that we sort of make the 20s into a black and white time of life, that either you're going to go out and explore and have the time of your life and do cool things, or you're going to sit down at a job and be miserable for the rest of your life. And I don't think it needs to be that way. And you were just talking about my first job out of college, working for Outward Bound. It was a great investment in my future. It gave me a lot of identity capital. It was also a lot of fun. And so I'll have people say to me, does your book mean I shouldn't be backpacking in my 20s? And my response is, you know, backpacking is not a full-time job, that you don't need to backpack 24/7 for 10 years. You can probably fit in cool things and ask for some favors and get going on identity capital and start to figure out what you want from a relationship. And that's part of being an adult, is figuring out how to have a multitasked, balanced life. But we kind of give 20-somethings some misleading and almost irresponsible advice. It's a bit of a baby boomer fantasy to say, get out there and have fun. I wish I'd done that. That's really not fair, because then these 20-somethings believe that's all there is to it. And then at 30, they try to get going on careers. They try to get going on relationships, and they feel that they've been misled. Since the book has come out, I've received a lot of emails from people saying, you're so right, and now I'm in my 30s. I'm working half as hard for twice the result. I wish I had known this years ago.
Twice as hard for half
sorry,
the
yes,
result.
Yes, I'm yeah. sorry. Twice as hard for half
the
result.
I knew what
result.
You meant. Probably yes. Most people listening did, too.
And, you know, there's a way to do both. It's not an either or in your 20s.
So you're not saying that you're against the idea that the 20s is the time for experimenting and trying different things while
right.
you still are not locked into family and
Absolutely.
Responsibility.
It's precisely the time for that.
But there's some balance that you need.
Right. Well, it's precisely the time for that. But we can also experiment with jobs and careers. We can experiment with relationships and what works for us and what doesn't work for us. But when we have this black and white idea of our 20s are for fun and our 30s are for starting my life, that's where people get into trouble. I think you can experiment on many fronts in your 20s. That's what's so great about the fact that people settle down later.
In your book, as an example of this, I think you tell a little bit about the life story of Eric Erickson.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about him.
Well, he's a great example because Eric Erickson is a psychoanalyst. He's passed away now, but he is the father of the identity crisis. He created that concept, hatched that idea that adolescence and early adulthood is a time for finding yourself or having a crisis and then arriving at an identity that you feel like you created. However, he also said in his writing that he was against people spending too much time in disengaged confusion. And really what he was advocating is something like a balance between identity crisis and identity capital.
And what you share in your book about his own life experience, I think, is mm-hmm. a really good example. Can you tell us a little of that?
Yeah, he thought he might like to be an artist. And so he spent some time after school traveling.
Well, you even tell about how he got the name Eric Erickson.
Right,
that was
yes.
not his name
yeah, right.
Uh-huh. At birth.
Yes, he was adopted by his stepfather and grew up with a name that he felt wasn't his name. And later he kind of went to find himself. He thought he might like to be an artist. He traveled around. He slept under bridges. He tried his hand at painting. Eventually he found his way toward education and then toward psychoanalytic training. And along the way, he changed his name from his birth name, which was Eric Homburger, to Eric Erickson, which literally means Eric, son of himself. That
sort of saying, I have made myself.
I have made myself. I am a self-made man. However, he did that through, yes, experimenting, but engaging. So he tried different jobs. He tried being an artist to say, does this work for me? Does this really add up? Or do I need to shift it a little bit? Then he shifted it to education. He met some weak ties that did some favors for him, and he shifted it to psychoanalytic training.
And he got into that training by about his mid-20s.
I think by his later 20s, yes. And he was.
So this, again, is an example of what you're talking about, is that the steps that you make in your 20s can be very important for what comes later. They don't have to be just a time to waste your time.
Right, absolutely. That experimenting really should be about engaging and accruing capital, personal capital, professional capital, relationship capital, and that's something you will keep trading on in your 30s and building on in your 30s and beyond.
So you just mentioned this other wonderful term that you explain in this book of yours, Meg Jay, The Defining Decade, that I'm sure anybody in their 20s will appreciate hearing about, but it certainly seems to me to apply to any adult can use this information about weak ties.
Mm-hmm. Weak ties. Weak ties is a phrase that comes from Mark Gronovitter's research. He was a sociologist at Stanford, and he did a seminal study, wrote a really important paper about 40 years ago now called The Strength of Weak Ties. And weak ties are people we don't know very well. They're the friends of friends of friends. They're the acquaintances. They're the neighbor's cousin. They are not our strong ties, which are our best friends and family. But the strength of weak ties is that they have a unique value in our life, which is Mark Gronovitter's research. He found that most people who had gotten a new job, that the job lead came from a weak tie. It came from someone they didn't know very well. And so when 20-somethings or people of any age are looking for a new job, they're probably going to hear about new opportunities, new openings, new ideas, new jobs, not from the same best friends they talk to five times a day or five times a week, but from people outside the inner circle. And it's really important, especially in young adulthood, to get out of that inner circle and to use your weak ties, to ask your weak ties for favors. That's how it all comes back to Ben Franklin. These are the people who are going to transform your career with one phone call, not your best friend.
And you give the example of how this book got published.
That's right.
In part because of your own weak ties.
That's right. It was pretty smooth because of my weak ties. I was teaching at Berkeley, and I was prepping some classes. I think I'd ordered some textbooks for publishers to look over. And a big box showed up on my front doorstep, and I opened it, and it was a box of 100 books from a publisher, from a particular editor, and I had not ordered it. So
mostly fiction?
It was a mix. It was some fiction, some academic, some popular, some, you know, very specific. So I was a little puzzled. I hadn't ordered it. I thought maybe it was a comp and thought, great. And then, you know, maybe a few days later, I thought I better follow up because this really wasn't meant for me. So there was a person's name on the invoice, so I sent this woman an email, and I said, my name is Meg Jay, I'm teaching at Berkeley, you sent me this box of books, did you mean to? And she, you know, very nicely emailed back that she has no idea why those books were sent to me, they were actually intended for another person, but just enjoy them. She asked me a question about teaching and choosing textbooks, and we had a few email exchanges, and that was it. And then I had started to think about writing this book because I had so many 20-somethings in my practice and in my classes, and I could see they were really hungry for information. When I would talk about ways to improve their lives, they would just lean forward. So I wrote up a book proposal, and I thought, okay, now I hear I'm supposed to get an agent or an editor or a publisher. What should I do next? I emailed this woman, and I said—
Who you'd never met?
Never met. I'd emailed with her all of 3 times. And I said, you know, I'm sorry if you hate this sort of thing, but I have a book proposal. Would you be willing to look at it and say, you're barking up the wrong tree, or I can suggest an agent for you. Just give me a little bit of feedback. It needed some reality testing. So she looked at it and said, this is a winner. Some phone calls were made. And very soon after, I had a publisher. You know, you go through the whole process of shopping it around and someone buying it. But that was very smooth, and it was all because of weak ties. And I think if I'd had to send out all those manila envelopes and get all those rejections, I had a busy life. I'm not sure I would have kept going with the process.
And this is a book that's only been out for a few weeks, and it's been rated as high as number 7 on the Amazon.
17.
Mm-hmm, 17. Mm-hmm. That's out of thousands of books that Amazon is selling. That's pretty impressive.
Yeah, so I guess she was right.
See you on the other side of your radio. If you are currently between the age of 20 and 29, what kind of thinking have you been doing about your future? What kinds of decisions have you been making that you think may affect where you go from here? 888-WMRA-TALK is how to reach us by phone. On Facebook, we're listed as Virginia Insight. Tell us, if you would, Meg Jay, about shopping for jam.
Shopping for jam. That is comes from a study called the JAM experiment. It was done by Sheena Iyengar at Stanford University. And it's really about how people make choices. So she was curious about how people make choices. And she had her research assistant set up tables of jam in a grocery store. And some of the tables had 30 flavors of jam. Some of them had 6 flavors of jam. And they noticed that for the tables that had 30 flavors, people got interested and excited and they flocked over, but they were less likely to taste jam or buy jam. For the tables that had 6 flavors of jam, people, there was less of a crowd around it, but when people did come to the table, they engaged with it, they tried jam, they chose a jar of jam, and left the store with something in hand. And what the conclusion that she and a lot of other researchers have drawn from that is that people become overwhelmed by the perception of too much choice. And so 20-somethings feel overwhelmed by their choices. They've heard...
So many people tell them with the best of intention, you can do anything you want.
Right? There's nothing more maddening or frustrating to a 20-something than hearing you can do anything. They also, by the way, really resent it when people say, you've got plenty of time, don't worry. And they are worried and they know
they can't do anything.
So
how do you respond to this? When you're faced with a client and he or she is saying, look, I have no idea what I should aim for in my life. All I've ever heard is I can do anything.
Right.
That doesn't make sense to me. Do you start trying to draw out of them what they think they're interested
Absolutely.
In, what they think they might
yes.
be good at, feeding back to them what you've perceived
exactly.
they're good at?
Yes, because it's not true that we can all be anything. There are plenty of things that just wouldn't have added up for me. And so in the book, I talk about a young man named Ian. He came in saying, I feel like I'm in the middle of an ocean. That's what my life feels like. I could swim in any direction, and I don't know how it's going to work out. And I could see why he felt that way. It's like standing in front of a table with 30 flavors of jam. But in reality, we've probably got about 5 or 6 flavors of jam in front of us. And so I worked with Ian on what 5 or 6 flavors did he have? What would it make any sense for him to do next? This isn't the last choice he was ever going to make, but he did need to make a choice. He needed to be able to make the next choice of what's the next thing I'm going to try? What's the first job I'm going to try to get? And so we talked a lot about what had he been good at so far, what might work in terms of supporting him or creating the life that he wanted, what was he interested in, what made him happy. And bringing all those things together, we figured out, okay, you should try this flavor of jam. This is your next step. You start there and you build on that. A lot of 20-somethings feel like if they don't make any choices, all their choices remain open. But not making choices is a choice all the same. You're choosing not to get going when a lot of people are.
Psychologist Meg Jay, near the end of this book, The Defining Decade, Why Your 20s Matter and How to Make the Most of Them Now, you talk about a trip, maybe it was to the Grand Canyon, but all I remember is that there were big mountains involved.
Yes, Rocky Mountain National Park.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and a sign you saw that said, mountains don't care.
Mm-hmm. I saw that sign. That was when I was in my 20s. I was, you know, tromping around with Outward Bound, and there was a big sign outside of Rocky Mountain National Park and these big, bold letters that said, mountains don't care. And underneath those big, bold letters was information about preparedness, what gear you needed, letting you know about avalanches and lightning storms. And I remember feeling terrified and appreciative of that sign, that sign was saying, if you go into the Rocky Mountains and you are not prepared, bad things can happen. You could get hurt, you could die, and nobody's going to care if you meant to bring your rain gear. Nobody's going to care if you were a really nice person. At the end of the day, things just are what they are, especially, you know, when you're in the wilderness, things just are what they are. And I really wrote The Defining Decade from that perspective, that I think a lot of 20-somethings have the best intentions. Their parents have the best intentions. They want good lives. But you have to be prepared. You have to know what you're getting into. You have to have all the information. And that's what The Defining Decade's all about.
You see how that can be somewhat intimidating in terms of people saying, I really don't know where to go next. If somebody's feeling that way, other than picking up your book, what advice would you give them in addition to picking up your book?
Right. start with what you know. You know something. People, you know something. So you start with what you know and you act on that, however temporarily, however short term, so that you learn a little bit more about the next step.
So it seems like one of the things that you're saying in the book is as important as it is to make decisions and to try things and to do things, it's not irrevocable.
Absolutely.
You try something. If it doesn't work, you try something else. It's just don't try nothing.
Exactly. That somebody said, you know, I thought life is all about reinventing yourself. And I said, absolutely, but you've got to have something to reinvent. There's a big difference between reinventing and trying to pull a rabbit out of a hat.
Our guest has been psychologist Meg Jay, assistant clinical professor at the University of Virginia's Curry School of Education, a therapist in private practice in Charlottesville, and author of the new book, The Defining Decade, Why Your 20s Matter and How to Make the Most of Them Now. Meg, thanks so much for your time.
It's been my pleasure.
You can find audio postings of Virginia Insight by going online to WMRA.org, then clicking on programs, and then clicking on Virginia Insight. If you go to that page, you'll find links to more information about the work that Dr. J is doing. Insight's executive producers, Matt Bingay, our associate producers, Terry Ward, and Bob Levicky. Thanks so much for tuning in for this edition. I'm Tom Graham. Hope we can get together again soon for more Insight.